And now, to attend a firm's February luncheon for an in-depth look at federal cybersecurity mandates. Learn from government leaders how to safeguard our country and protect the privacy of our citizens. That's Thursday, February 17th at 11:30 a.m. at the George Washington University Marvin Center in Washington, D.C. Register today at www.affirm.org.
Newsmakers, talk to Jason Miller.
David Blumenthal, the National Coordinator for Health IT.
The health IT sector is short of trained professionals. So we've created a nationwide health information technology training program. 84 community colleges are receiving support to train health IT professionals. This year we're going to graduate 3,400, and we hope annually thereafter to graduate 10,000 a year until we reach a total of 40,000.
Hear the entire interview online, federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here this morning to talk with Ernest Porter, do a biographical verbal sketch of Ernest's career, starting from a GS2 ending up to a very high level GS rating. I hate to say numbers, but it was really high, and accomplished an awful lot. Good morning, Ernest.
Good morning, Bob.
And I can call you Ernie?
Ernie is fine.
Okay, great. And Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, Weekly GovExec Columnist, Seminar Presenter, and good friend. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
And Tammy, you know Ernest off the mic, right? So this
is
your first time.
Oh, yeah, I don't know Ernest at all. I know Ernie.
Okay.
But yeah, Ernie and I go back probably 1981,
yes.
So something like that.
Yes.
So almost from the beginning of my career, not quite the beginning of his.
Yes.
So this is the Ernie day, but more importantly, Ernie had the opportunity to do what he did because of where he worked, not necessarily the FBI, but the federal government. Now, it was the FBI. Mm-hmm. And you ended up your career, and we'll get back to that in a while, you know, at one of the highest levels, but you started in the mailroom as a GS2, and before we came on in the proverbial green room, you were telling me that was not uncommon when you first started. Now, how long was your service?
37 years plus.
Scant 37 years. All right. But you started, and we're not that different in age. You're much younger by about 3 or 4 years. But point being is, you started there, and just out of curiosity, what got you to say, okay, I'm going to stay here, but I can zig and I can zag, but I'm going to stay in the same agency? And you were given the opportunity to do, I won't say pretty much what you wanted to do, but you got to do what you did because you were good. Now, besides, you know, being modest, how did you become good at these different things? I mean, what opportunities did the federal government provide you that you wouldn't have otherwise?
The FBI itself, Bob, is a very diverse. Even when I started, it had very, very many opportunities for people, different divisions, different functions, and so on. The FBI is best known, of course, for its agent force, but it has still a lot of other opportunities. Back then, though, the most employees that came on started in the lower grades, grade 2, grade 3, grade 4, if you could type real fast, maybe grade 5 if you knew something about computers. But even though I started off in what was then known as the Identification Division, which is now the Criminal Justice Information Division in West Virginia, there were still quite a few opportunities there or elsewhere. But I got to know people, and I got to definitely see that there were other directions I could go in, particularly given my interest in writing and in public relations, public information.
I remember when I worked there, there used to be a board that they would publish the jobs that were open, and
yes,
you could apply for those jobs. Do they
yes.
still have that system where you can find the openings?
That went the way of
computers,
automation. Now, today, in recent years, jobs are posted it on government jobs, USA jobs.
Yes. I remember staring at that board thinking, oh, I could do that, I could do that. You know, they'd tell what the qualifications were, and you could put in for whatever you wanted to, thought you were good at or thought you could do.
Yes.
And you have a normal background as well, Jersey Shore, and yes. We talked before we came on, you'd met Bruce Springsteen. I wanted to know that way back when, before he was Bruce Springsteen. And
how did you have an opportunity to meet him?
I went to one of the shows he was putting on at what's called the Stone Pony. Stone Pony is still there in Asbury Park, New Jersey, which is on the shore. So that was a destination for young people even back then.
Wow. Yeah, and that's where, I mean, he got his notoriety, and then the rest is history. And Yankees fan, I guess that's going to alienate some, but I'm a Yankee fan.
It is, and I'm still not happy that Pittsburgh beat the Yankees in 1960.
Careful.
Boy Scout. Pittsburgh. I mean, so again, we got this really normal base that turned into, and you're CPA too, right?
No, sir.
Oh, I thought we were going to share something in common. Anyway.
My father was an accountant.
I
majored in accounting my first year in college, but that's the closest I came to a CPA.
You were smart not to take the exam. All right. So what got you out of wherever you were and you said, okay, I want to take one step further? Mm-hmm. And I think this is very important for people that just came into the federal government and will walk through in the mid-career as well. So this is a true story, normal beginnings and abnormal end in a good way. Mm-hmm. So what got you out of, say, okay, I want to get out of this box and go to another box?
I knew, of course, that working in the mailroom and some of the other things was going to be an entry-level temporary job. And I kept my eye on the various opportunities that I would hear about. And my first opportunity, I wanted to do something with writing and public information. So I was here about 5 months, and the Employee Magazine had an article about they were starting a external affairs division and radio, TV, running the FBI tour, congressional liaison. And I went right into my supervisor's office, the high-ranking agent at the time. And, of course, he was very used to everybody and his brother wanting to come and talk to him about doing something else. Mm-hmm. But it just so happens he was rather sympathetic. And I went home that afternoon. He called me at home and said, I'm sending you over to the Department of Justice, the main building, and I'm going to set you up for some interviews. And then I got hired as still an entry-level writer, but in that public relations operation, and I was on my way.
And that was what really kept your attention from there on out.
Yes, and I started working with the Employee Magazine and doing case summaries, and then that went into writing articles and then working with researching and TV, radio, and the motion pictures all through the career.
But along the way, what training opportunities did the federal government provide you that made you more aware? You probably knew what you wanted to do, but made you more aware of sharpening your skills. Were the courses that you took, or did you just have inane habit?
Most of it was just my own interests and occasional seminars and various other courses, either through OPM or through the Department of Agriculture. And then later on, I did go to graduate school, the University of Maryland, and just concentrated on organizational communications and all the other things that they teach you when you get a master's degree in administration.
Along the way, what did you find challenging? Again, you're working for an agency that, you know, in that era, there was just, you know, they were on Mount Olympus, if you will. I'm not saying that they're not now, but back then, you know, the FBI. But they were also very guarded, and like I said at the top of the show, and they should be. So how did you bridge that gap between being able to advise, like, these TV shows or radio shows or articles and whatnot, without saying anything that you shouldn't? That had to be hard. Or to say, listen, that's wrong, or we don't want that on the air.
It's a delicate balance, a real ballet at times about what the FBI can say about its operations. We're more open when talking about training fugitives, missing persons, were a lot less open to talk about, let's say, intelligence matters, counterterrorism matters, and so on. But there, every time a request comes in, it's not a simple matter for us just to necessarily start talking about it. There is often a lot of consultation between the public affairs office on even the most minor of things to make sure that we're all on the same page and that we coordinate well. And that's true of our field offices when they make comments and with headquarters making comments as well.
My father-in-law, rest his soul, was an FBI and a cryptologist, handwriting expert. And he could examine banknotes and was called on as an expert witness, but didn't talk that much about the nitty-gritty, not because he was just a delight to be around, but, you know, he couldn't say that much, but he could talk a little bit. Once you got him going, he could talk about things that happened, but not necessarily how
specific,
it happened.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to me what the power, and this was, you know, pre-supercomputers, and his ability to function within that environment and be successful.
There's a lot that the FBI can say, and we these people, we tell them that there's a lot that we can't tell you. And journalists understand that, producers understand that, the authors that we have wonderful stories to tell about our history or our functions, our law enforcement services, and so on, but we can only go so far.
Yeah, that's one of the things we still miss is the old FBI tour route, which I think was it the second most popular tour aside from the White House?
It was. It was. That's where I met Tammy when she was working there and I was working elsewhere.
Right.
And in busy days, they would have 5,000 people come through there. So that was a very good public information exposure for the FBI with that tour.
Yeah, I went to that, and I thought it was the best tour.
Mm-hmm. It was a great tour. I mean, it ended with the machine gun demonstration.
The Tommy
you got to
guns,
see the real laboratory where your dad probably worked there.
Yes.
So it was not just displays, but it was actual working part of the Bureau as well. So I think it was an interesting tour, and I was always happy to have spent a little bit of time there.
And for those of you, when you do come to Washington, and this show is broadcast nation worldwide live today, and today is, what, January 31st, and we're off at about 5 to 11, but it's archived, so if you're listening to it other than that time, it is archived. And if you are listening to it live, you can call us. We're at 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. And you can talk to Ernie, and you can talk to Tammy about benefits. We got a couple emails we'll get to in a little bit, or you could talk to me about tax and finance.
Hey, this is the time of year to talk about taxes.
Yeah, and
I'm subject at home this weekend.
Taxes. I do mine October 14th. What's the rush? Anyway, so I'm looking at your kind of bio, and I was just kind of bowled over. CSI Las Vegas, you advise them. CSI Miami Criminal Minds, Cold Case Files, X-Files. That must have been chilling.
Yes.
And you've been on Good Morning America, The Nancy Grace Show, Bloomberg Financial, Wall Street Journal, 60 Minutes. I mean, the list could go on and on. But that's and did the FBI then send you out if somebody like 60 Minutes or somebody calls up and said, we want somebody to talk to? Well, they can't just hand the phone to anybody. They have to hand it to somebody that really knows what's going on but isn't going to say, oh, yeah, this is how we do it.
My role in the Office of Public Affairs was mainly to broker interviews with all those outlets with FBI subject matter experts, and then set up the interviews and then make sure that they had a follow up questions that we would take care of that need for them as well. I would be a spokesman now and then, but my primary role was more the coordinator, the facilitator.
Conduit, getting the two people together that needed to connect.
As I mentioned before, there's a lot of preparation and background and going back and forth before we can cooperate with a book, do an interview, and so on.
Now, did you ever, when you had the interviews, you were kind of the police person there, if you will, so that if the person was being interviewed was going off where someplace they didn't go, you got to kind of time out or
Yes.
Get them back yes. off of that area. Yeah. And that's yes. hard.
Yeah. We have some pretty savvy people, and we do train our people, even in new agents class and in executive seminar, management seminars, about working with the media, what you can answer, what you cannot. And that works very well for us.
Okay, now you have a finance background, and you know, usually yes. I would say accountants anyway, but finance people aren't necessarily so public. They really know their stuff, but they're not always the most outgoing. and to be able to do this, you had to balance the two really well. What would you say was the your finest memory of a course that you took that took you from center to right or left, or seminar in the FBI, or training course? Is there one that stands out?
I would say the FBI, the Executive Development Institute that I went to in my mid career, where they take you for 2 weeks and they give you seminars and situations where you have to be on a team and resolve the issue, and that was very, very enlightening. That was really felt like you were part of management, and you had arrived when you went mm-hmm. to that type of training.
And that was off-site, I guess.
That was down at our training academy at Quantico for 2 weeks. We stayed down there and had meals together and lectures together, and it was quite good.
Yeah, I remember many years ago, maybe even pre-NITP, somebody asked me to do somebody was ill and they couldn't do the retirement seminar in Florida. It was a real rough assignment at the Peabody in Orlando. This is before Orlando became Orlando. And then I had the ducks come down. But here are these 300 top people in the FBI sitting in one room. And even then, this is pre-terrorists and stuff. I go, 300 of these people in one room? But it was a five-day course, and it was probably the longest and best and most concentrated retirement course that I had ever been around. And not only did they have good speakers other than, you know, besides me, but they had kind of one-on-one counseling. And Tammy, you might have gone to these, and they would talk to the agents.
Yeah, at the time I started in the retirement office was about the time FERS was being introduced. And I never got to attend any of those because somebody had to stay back at home base and do the counseling at home, and I was the junior person. But I've heard good stories about those off-site, because they used to do one in San Diego, one in Orlando, and I think one in D.C. And so that's shipped the employees who were getting close to retirement to have that training so they can prepare properly.
Yeah, they were renowned, and one of the folks that comes on the show and one of the folks that speaks at the seminars and runs SAMBA now, Walt Wilson,
he was
still the gentleman he was way back then, and he is now. Mm-hmm. He was on, what, a couple months ago during open season?
Yeah, we were talking about health insurance. But yeah, he helped plan those seminars.
And, he did.
They've evolved over the years. I think now it's a three-day course.
Most agencies
now do a three-day
retirement
training.
Yeah, I took 3 days.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm lucky enough to have, when I did these seminars, fortunately a few would come in and become clients, and, you know, we'd do the tax work, and they were very straight, and occasionally, you know, they would never talk about stuff that they shouldn't, but, you know, I'd ask them, I said, how do you do this? And this one particular case was fairly rough what they did. I said, how do you, he says, well, you know, at first it's not pleasant, but this is how you, it was body identification.
Probably latent examiners.
Yes.
That was always a very intriguing type of work.
Yeah.
One that I could never do.
No, and I don't know how you train somebody to do that. And I guess I don't know whether there's a high dropout rate, but to be able to identify some of the things that I guess they have to identify because of fires or because of
plane crashes,
explosions, plane crashes, et cetera. That's rough. So the FBI, initially when I was growing up, thought it just did one thing. But, I mean, then you start to learn they did everything in order to get to that place.
I saw it as a good opportunity to work your way through the ranks, because they did have, and I think that's probably true of a lot of federal agencies. It's just this was our experience there. But, you had a lot of chances to do all you wanted to be for yourself and have that advantage of moving up through the ranks if that was what you desired.
Yeah, you did. The latent fingerprint examiners, they had to start off at the lower grades examining the fingerprint cards that law enforcement and military and banks, let's say, would send in schools for background checks. So you had to stay with that for quite a while until there was an opening mm-hmm. in that latent fingerprint work.
That was a big promotion and an honor to be asked to be in that section because not everybody got that.
No, latent is now, has been in recent years, part of the FBI laboratory. It was part of the identification division, but they because of the impact and the interaction with evidence, they moved it to the FBI lab sometime.
Is that all down in Quantico?
Yes, it is. Yes.
And working so closely with the folks and not being able to talk necessarily about what you did with friends outside of the Bureau, did you find that a lot of your social friends were also work friends?
Yes. In the early days in particular, that was not unusual. Mm-hmm. Part of it is because that's who you mainly got to know, in addition to the people who lived down the hall from you in the apartment complex or people that I went to school with in the graduate school or so on. That was not unusual. And also, I think most FBI people were kind of circumspect about who our friends should be, could mm-hmm. be.
Yeah, my father-in-law was like that, and his wife. And a lot of their friends, as I remember, were FBI folks.
Well, we used to call it a family.
Yes, yeah, they still do. Mm-hmm.
And oddly enough, they went to college in your hometown, my father-in-law and his wife.
In Union?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, small world.
Yeah. I showed my wife this, and I said, look at this. She said, that's where my parents went to school.
Anyway. One of the things I think is interesting, and one of the reasons why I wanted Ernie to come on the show today, was because he's someone who has retired, so we wanted to talk a little bit about his preparations for retirement, but also from... There was a time in his career where he had to make a big decision, and anybody in the government at this time had to make that decision, which was to stay under the old civil service system or to move into the FIRST system. And that was where I got started training, was teaching some of those classes with my old supervisor, Patty Regal, and Ernie attended the classes to learn about the differences between SIRS and FIRS. And he had to make a choice. Do I want to stay in the path going under the so-called old system, or do I want to take advantage of the TSP and the Social Security coverage and just a little more flexibility with the FIRS system? What did you decide to do?
I was one of the rare people, maybe 3% of all the current federal population at the time, that decided to switch to FIRS. I started my career, of course, under the 3 years of Social Security, and then was blessed and allowed to come into the civil service system. And I was just happy with that, and looking down the road, I fully planned to stay with that. And then the government offered this option of the transfer system. So I went to the seminars. I had the seminar, software run, made some projections, and I switched FIRS.
Was your background in finance a little bit something to do with that, with projecting what the potential with the TSP might have been?
It was. I had my father was an accountant, and in my first year of college, I was a business major, and I had all these financial balances and techniques and all drilled into me, 8 hours of accounting by a professor that went to Wharton. He had a photographic memory, and every other week there was a test, and he filled the blackboard time and time again. He never had a book or notes.
Wow.
He was quite something. But influences like this made me look maybe differently at the option that FIRS was giving me as opposed to just staying in the civil service. It was not an easy decision, but the flexibility of the system, the projections that I had at the time indicated for me that I could expect a higher overall payout with the combination of the 14 years at the time that I had in civil service with the FIRS, with Social Security.
Mm-hmm. You kind of got the best of both worlds because you had established some time under civil service, which is still part of your retirement.
It is.
But then the FERS portion lets you take advantage of your knowledge of investments and investing.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, one of the problems for a lot of employees at that time was we didn't know anything about investing. If you didn't have that background in finance, you know, what did we know about the stock market or the C fund or the F fund and the bonds? So I think it scared most of us. I had to learn from ground zero what it was to be an investor to manage your retirement income, where you kind of had a little bit of that.
I had some exposure already. I'd already had made my first mutual fund investment in 1977, a whopping $1,000.
They had mutual funds?
Yeah, they did. They did. And also, when IRAs were widely available, made available in 1982, I had opened one of those, and I had been putting in the $2,000 maximum for a few years before the FERS option came along. So I looked at it more as a opportunity to
take advantage of that side of the retirement system. Where you
now, our listeners now that have to be in FERS or are in FERS, and they're not so comfortable with finances, what advice would you give them? Of course, they should attend one of our retirement seminars, but that sounds self-serving. But where could they get that? Where could they get information? Because it's so key to them to make that money work for them and not just bury it in one fund and leave it there. If you had to give counsel to somebody specifically or the folks listening in general, what should they do to maximize their opportunity that you saw at a young age?
I would say that they should absolutely put in as much money into the thrift savings plan as they can. If they're not sure of what to do, they don't like to make decisions. I'm pretty much a supporter of the L fund concept. Just pick one that's closest to the year that you plan to withdraw the money, not necessarily that you plan to retire. And the Thrift Savings Plan Board will balance that for you. But the key, I think, is for people to put as much money aside as you can. There's tax savings there right away. And if you're over 50, definitely put in the
catch-up.
And then getting the match, it will build that balance up quite rapidly.
In a way, it serves as a deferred 5% pay raise that now you have access to now that you're retired.
Exactly.
Yeah, and people, you know, when we go into classes, well, they have to do that. And I go, no, they don't have to do that. And besides, it's 100% rate of return on the first 5% of your money. There's no place that guarantees that, as in no place.
No place.
And then guard it. And like you say, put the additional amount in. And I'll take a quick segue to taxes with regards to the 2% Social Security holiday, if you will, for the 1 year. That's kind of a tax-free raise when you're not getting a raise. And if you haven't maxed the thrift, what a great opportunity. Because now you've turned something that you don't have to pay taxes on into a tax deduction that'll grow tax-deferred until the day you take it out.
Yeah, I think what a lot of people don't realize till they actually start contributing heavier to the thrift is the fact that you might be putting in $300 a pay period, but it doesn't seem like it because you've lowered your taxable income and you don't have as much being withheld for tax purposes.
Yeah.
So it's not as painful as you might expect. Yeah, I agree with all the advice Ernie gave to the mid-career and even the new employee. Try to do as much as possible from an early time.
Yeah, let's take another quick, just little segue here. Something came out today that a retiree got their, I guess it was their, was it the January check or the February check? The February check, and the net bring home was less because the tax withholding went up.
Yeah.
And people are perplexed with this, but let's remember our tax laws were in flux for the better part of 2010, and the IRS... And that's why a lot of people can't file their tax returns till mid-February, as well as OPM was under the assumption that there would be new tax rates higher than what they were. But Congress, very late in December, passed a law to say, nah, we'll stay with the lower tax rates for 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, the computers, you can't turn a computer around in 8 days. And so I would imagine it's going to be fixed. I don't think it's going to cause anybody any unnecessary ability to pay for their groceries, but nonetheless, it's kind of a shock. No cola and reduced take home.
Withheld.
But remember, it's taxes just being withheld for you to get back at some later date, and they'll probably steady the course, I would think.
So you wouldn't suggest anyone to change their exemptions?
No, because
or just leave
then.
Mess it up for the rest of the year.
They'll mess it up because they'll right the ship, and maybe there's a few extra dollars sitting in there for a year, and so it'll increase the refund or decrease the balance due. But it's no reason to get all upset.
Right, because even folks like Ernie, because you're still in interim status.
I am still in interim 6 months after retiring,
and yes. And you also took a cut in your tax withholding or an increase in your tax withholding even off the interim tax.
It was just about $25, but it still was a check.
Yeah, still a little less than what you had been receiving.
Yes.
That's the other thing I thought we should talk a little bit about, because I know a lot of employees are concerned about the news that comes from OPM, and they've been very transparent and clear about this, that they've got a backlog of retirement cases that they're working through, and it's going to get probably a little worse before it gets better, because they're still training some employees to handle those cases, and we have employees who continue to retire. So Ernie retired the end of July
yes.
of last year, and was immediately put into what's called interim retired status, because you
yes.
got your first check by when?
By September 1st.
Which would have been the August payment, which
yes.
was right on time.
And then I got a raise of a few hundred dollars for October, starting in October, and then that amount has stayed
the same until this last check.
They notified us by a mail form the other day.
And what that means to be an interim status, it means that OPM is working on his case. It hasn't been put into final pay status, so they're paying him less than what his estimated retirement benefit's going to actually be. So at the end, whenever they finalize his case, they'll probably send you some money, because they're probably withholding more than what
yes.
they really need to be. They're erring on the side of caution.
That's what they've told me.
Yeah.
Okay, so and for those listening, you just heard the be-all, know-all of things federal benefits, Tammy, talking with somebody that knows it but lives it. And you hear in class, at least I hear it, and you probably hear it more so than I do, Tammy, I have a friend that hasn't got their annuity for 6 months. Well, they get, what do you call it, interim status?
Interim check. Sometimes it's referred to as special pay, but I think OPM's referring to it now as interim retired status.
Mm-hmm. It's not the full annuity, but eventually does catch up. Mm-hmm. The people don't lose their money. It's just until they can, what do you call it, adjudicate the paper? Is that what you call it?
Although now they're calling it finalizer, speaking in English, but
okay.
Yeah, we used to call it adjudication process. But, yeah, what's hurtful sometimes for an employee who's retired, who doesn't have anything to fall back on, and they're getting less money than they had even expected. And I think for some folks, retirement itself is a big adjustment financially. And so they're worried that, you know, how long is the special pay period going to last? And, you know, what investments do I have to cash out in order to make that work? But I know one of the things some people do, and you may have done this yourself, Ernie, is that last few months or year even that you work, you might have tried to save up some annual leave.
I did.
So you get that payment from annual leave from your payroll office. We're at the FBI. It's a National Finance Center who does payroll.
The NFC sent me my my final check within 2 weeks of when I retired. And they also, within about 3 or 4 weeks, they sent me a check for the balance
of your annual leave.
of my annual leave. So they were pretty prompt with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and payroll is kind of anxious to get you off the payroll, because that means you're separated from the agency. So that's the last check that they're going to send you would be your lump sum annual leave payment. That normally comes within 4 to 6 weeks of most people's separation. So yours was...
Yes. Jumped right on time.
Classic case. Yeah, classic case of that happening.
There's a question that we get in class, I get in class, probably Tammy more so than I, and the benefit speakers, and it regards paybacks of things. And I think you both would have a better response than I ever could here. Mm-hmm. If somebody asks you that, should I pay back the $6,000 for something that they took out, or what else would
Ernie's
I pay back
got
before?
One, because it's his first 3 years. At the FBI, it was very traditional that when we would hire an employee, and I believe it even applied to the agents at the time, that they would be brought on board under temporary, not to exceed 1 year appointments. And that would be renewed every year for the first 3 years of the career. And so until about 1980, maybe a little bit prior to that, everybody who retired would find out, usually near retirement, even though we probably should have told them when they were first hired, that they had a period of what we called non-deduction service. This was time where you were covered by Social Security, you weren't paying into civil service, And it would have a slight impact on your retirement, because if that money stayed missing, if you never paid it back, there would be a reduction to your civil service annuity. So you probably got that information either at the seminar or in your retirement estimate.
I did. Last spring, when I first decided to retire, sat down with the FBI's retirement staff. And the FBI, by the way, does retirement, I think, very, very well.
They'll still meet with you face-to-face?
Yes, they do.
That's unusual.
And they have an intranet site with all sorts of information, and they do a really good job with it. But as part of the forms they gave me, they gave me an estimate of what that payback information amount would be. I think they estimated it would be about $4,000. And if I paid it back, my annuity would be about $38 a month more in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. So I elected to pay the money back. And that's,
you plan to live more than 10 years?
Yes. So I did the math, and I said, well, ultimately I'll come out ahead.
Yeah, and it's kind of a guaranteed 10%. In that particular case, we're talking about pre-1982 deposits, which is what you had. It's a 10% return on the money you invest. So once you've lived 10 years, probably a little less with cost of livings if
yes.
we ever get those again, you'll get the money back that you paid. And then if you continue living, you'll get it back every year for the rest of your life. So it could turn out to be a very good choice to pay that back.
Yes.
Where other people look at it the opposite. They'll say, oh, $38 a month, who cares? And they just leave it unpaid. And I don't really have a problem with either answer. As long as you understand, you have a choice.
And for those of you all listening, this is NITPs. We're a federal benefit retirement seminar provider. We don't sell anything. We sell seminars to the federal government. But you can follow up with us if you like. You can email us at 4YOUR benefit@NITPINC.com. For your benefit at NITPINC.com. And this was not a sales tool, but the point being is what Tammy and Ernie talked about are just one of a multitude of things people mm-hmm. face, sometimes mid-career.
Yes,
certainly
we're finding that people like to hear these things mid-career rather than the
yes.
year before they leave, because then they can make these choices where they still have plenty of time ahead of them to either pay it off if that's what they plan to
the
do
FBI
or just be aware
that.
Of it.
Yeah, the FBI is actually doing that. They realize that it's better to bring in people, at least for even mini seminars, mm-hmm. not 3-day seminars, but just more awareness
right.
at any time during the career.
Yeah, we get a good response to the mid-careers as well.
Right, but we will answer those questions. I don't think there's a question we can't answer. I mean, we can't provide guidance and say you should do this because, you know, what do you know from an emailer? But we certainly can give them the facts on which to base. And because the federal retirement system, while fabulous, just has an awful lot of, well, what ifs.
There's a lot of nuances,
yeah.
And I think that's what's making it so difficult to even create the software to do these final processing, because there's just so many laws through the 91 years of civil service existence that have changed and amended things, so it's difficult.
Which might be a segue to an email you sent me yesterday, Tammy, and it's an individual, and they have this question, and mm-hmm. the question is, I'm a 59-year-old FERS employee eligible to retire immediately with MRA plus 10. What's that mean, Tammy?
It means that this employee is old enough to retire. She's 59, but she doesn't have as much service as Ernie had, so she's not eligible for an unreduced retirement. She has more than 10 years, but she has less than 30. And under FERS, you can take immediate retirement, but you're going to take a reduction. In the case of this employee who's 59 years old, if she takes that benefit immediately, her retirement's going to be reduced by 5% for every year that she's under 62. So if she's 59, it would be about a 15% reduction.
And then she said, if I defer collecting any benefits until I'm 62 in order to avoid the penalty, mm-hmm. can I still retire now, or must I resign now and then apply for retirement in 3 years? That's one question.
Mm-hmm.
If I resign and should die suddenly, I would have no survivor benefits, having neither employee nor retiree status. Also, eligibility/benefit rules could change. All right, you tackle that one,
okay.
Tammy.
Okay, it's not as bad as I think she's envisioning, which is the good news. Because if she leaves the government at 59, having more than 10 years of service, she's considered eligible to retire even though she's not applying for the benefit. So her concern about what if I should die before I actually get a chance to receive the benefit, if she survived by a spouse, her spouse would still be entitled to full survivor benefits as if she had retired the day she died. So he in this case, he would be entitled to receive the spousal benefit as if she had elected it.
Would it only be a spouse, Tammy, or could it be anybody that could receive a survivor's annuity? I know it's odd.
Well, the only person would be a spouse, a former spouse with a court order, or if she has dependent children.
Okay.
When she retires, when she actually applies for the retirement, she can elect something called insurable interest, which could name somebody else to receive a survivor annuity, but that election won't be made until she retires. So okay, if she dies prior to that, it would be
just... And that three-year gap. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and if there is no spouse, no dependent children, then any money that she had paid into the retirement fund would be returned to her beneficiary.
And I thought taxes were hard.
This is easy.
Yeah.
But we don't call it a deferred retirement. It's kind of technical. You know, you think, what's deferred, postponed? We call this a postponed annuity because she's actually eligible for it. She's just postponing the receipt of it to avoid that 15% penalty. So I think her plan is fine as long as she doesn't need the money right now and as long as she doesn't need the health insurance, because she would postpone that as well, health and life insurance.
There was something else today, too. Tammy, you know much more about this than I, and I went into work, of course, before I came here, and there's something from GovExec, the outfit that you made famous, Tammy, and it says OPM to launch long-term care insurance open season. Now, what's the deal with that?
Big news. This is big news, I think, because we haven't had a long-term care open season since long-term care started 8 years ago. And a lot of employees have asked about that. Are we going to have another open season? What's the story? Well, the fact is long-term care enrollment has been open ever since it started. I mean, if you wanted to sign up today, you can enroll. You have to just answer questions about your health and get accepted. But when it's open season time, during the first open season, there was abbreviated underwriting where you didn't have to answer as many health-related questions as you would at other times. So that's what's going to happen this April. So starting April 4th, and the Federal Register that went out on Friday had it ending in May, but I think this week it'll be corrected till June. So the open season is actually going to run just about 3 months, April, May, and June of this year. And so employees and their spouses who want to enroll in long-term care insurance that haven't done so can now do so this spring under the abbreviated underwriting. Now, if it's your parents, if it's a retiree, if it's a spouse of a retiree, those folks can still enroll, and it doesn't have to be open season. They can do it any time, but you'll have to file the full underwriting application. So the big thing about the open season is going to be just getting the word out, giving a chance for employees to get more understanding of what long-term care insurance is, and also offer current employees and their spouses less underwriting requirements when they sign up. So it could be an advantage for someone who wants to enroll and wants more information.
I have an idea. Mm-hmm. Why don't we do a series of shows? And maybe one show would just be, two shows would be folks from long-term care come on with us, either voice or in the flesh. Maybe, maybe not, if they can do it. And then maybe another one, just not like that, but get somebody like the old, the big go against each other, should I or shouldn't I? Mm-hmm. Somebody that really knows the stuff, and maybe an economist or a financial planner, and do something like that. And then people could refer to it, and like we did with the Roth conversions, we could put a PDF file up on the website, right, so that they could have information in hand. And I understand the long-term care folks are going to do 600 presentations on this around the country.
They'll be out training, I'm sure, the whole time during the open season, because one of the main things is to get the word out and bring this back to our attention. Because, you know, after we had that initial rollout when it first started, it kind of died down a little bit, and you know, they kept getting enrollments, but I think having an open season is going to get our attention focused on what is this type of insurance, what is it for, do I need it, how much does it cost? So I think this is a great opportunity. I think an idea of having a series of shows is probably right in line with that, so I hope we can do that.
Okay, probably.
I'll be here. I'll participate.
Okay, we can't do it in March, but sometime in April.
April or May,
yeah,
because the open season, like I said, is going to be pretty extensive. So that's good. That's
all right.
Good.
Ernie, sorry we took the spotlight off you, but we did have that email, and we always like to do our email.
No problem.
Yeah, I got one other email. I just wanted to share a similar story, because if our listeners think that Ernie's is a unique story, it really isn't, right? You can attest to that, because I'm sure you know other people that rose up through the ranks with you.
Absolutely.
And this woman who wrote, just happened to write to me, not even knowing what we were going to do this weekend, Carol wrote in, and she said that she wanted to share her story that started in 1969 at age 14. 14 years old, she was participating in a program called Stay in School in the federal government in D.C. D.C. was she called it a federal city, and if you work for the D.C. government, you were civil service. And so her career started at age 14. And she's now 55 years old as a GS-14, so almost the top of a GS-14, which is about as high as you can go given one more grade. And she's going to retire with 2 years of sick leave and 37 years of service after that career at a very young age. She's only 55. So she's really another success story of how a federal career can really work out. And must have been very healthy as well. Lucky enough to have enjoyed good health and saved up her sick leave, which counts.
And dedicated.
Very dedicated.
That's dedication.
And you can see from the wording of her email, just very proud of what she has accomplished. She says, proud and happily retired public servant. I just wanted to share my story. And so,
that's very nice.
I thought it was another heartwarming story. Because we hear all these negative comments about, you know, problems in processing and problems in finances and the stock market. So it's good to hear some positive feedback from employees who have retired recently and who are planning to retire, and things are working out fairly well. So
yeah,
far,
I got
so
an
good.
Email this morning from a fan of the show on the West Coast and said, would you do a show on privatization of Social Security? And I said, no.
No, that's too political.
And not because it was his idea. He's a very smart individual, but politically, I don't think I want to go near that.
No,
and
that's
plus,
not
it's
what
just
we do.
Too hard. It's economics. 5'10", as far as one being able to manage their own money versus the Social Security.
And that's never really been our place to try and say anything along
and
those lines.
He has some really good questions that I bring up on the show, but that one I just don't think we can do.
Although I do have a novel idea.
And what is that?
I got an email from another person. I received a lot of emails last week. I think with the snow we had here in Washington, I had a chance to actually think about some of them. And this was a guy who wrote to me that said he was going to retire on January 12th of 2013. And at first I fired back at him and I said, January 12th, don't you know you're supposed to retire the end of the month, the first 3 days of the month? And his logic was he's under FERS and he'll have almost 28 years of service by the time he planned to retire on this date. And he said, he made a good point. He says, my retirement's going to be worth his FERS basic benefit, not his thrift plan, not his Social Security, but his FERS basic benefit's worth about $1,800 a month. 2 weeks of salary for this guy's $3,000 for a biweekly paycheck. So his logic was, I'd retire January 12th, which is the end of the leave year that year. And so he'd accumulate one last accrual of annual leave, a full paycheck for working that last 2 weeks. He'll get his first retirement check March 1st for the month of February. He's going to lose his January check, but in exchange for the loss of that check, he's getting a full paycheck, another accumulation of leave. He could make a contribution to the TSP out of that last paycheck. So in a way, I think he's got a point. So I may have to change my advice on the best date being the end of the month for some FERS employees, because even somebody with 28 years of service, you would think that that annuity check would be more than a biweekly paycheck, but it really isn't. So... Something I'm going to explore with my best date column later this year.
And Tammy's best date column is, of course, outstanding, but she does it well in advance of the next year. I think for the best date in 2011, you did it in June or April or something last year.
Yeah, because I get a lot of questions about that. Yeah. People are very confused about choosing a retirement date. And I always say, you know, this is easy, choosing the date. You can't make a huge mistake whether you pick the 12th or the 31st or the 3rd. The hard thing is knowing if you're financially ready and mentally prepared. I was kind of curious to know, like, how did you know that this was the time to retire? Because you didn't have to. You could have worked another 5 years if you wanted to. And I know you were enjoying what you were doing. So how did you make that decision?
I could have worked indefinitely.
That's right. You could have been like Millie Parsons that stayed till she was 88.
She did.
Yep.
She did.
Another fellow FBI employee.
Really?
Yeah. Mike used to write about her all the time. Millie stayed 62 years and 9 months, and her claim to fame was never using an hour of sick leave.
And she didn't.
And she didn't. No, she really didn't.
She did. She had years of sick leave built up.
Yep. And she really enjoyed her work. I mean, she enjoyed working in the field office is where she spent her career.
That's a good question, Tammy. When did the button click?
It's more recent years. I could have retired in January of 2006, but I really, really liked what I was doing. Wanted to do a few more things. The FBI was, for example, celebrating its 100th anniversary in 2008, and with all my work with FBI history, I definitely wanted to be part of that. But basically, I decided to retire, began to think of it late last year, and then put in the papers in April. But I felt I had just performed all the activities and reached the goals that I wanted to. I was turning 60. I could freely make withdrawals from the TSP, and also the big financial consideration is that I could qualify for the combined CSRS FERS annuity supplement and take out a modest TSP withdrawal of about 5% a year, and it would equal most of my salary. And as they tell you in the seminars, the get out of bed index, you know, what you're grossing with your salary versus what you can make
as much staying home every day, it doesn't make
as much financial sense. And then there is, you know, the opportunity for just shifting gears after 37 years and going on to a second career. And but I'm enjoying my sabbatical for the past 6 months. So retirement is definitely a pleasant phase of life so far.
And to bring in last week's guest, Dr. Michael Creedon, he does it on the psychological gerontology side of it. And it mirrors just what you said. You planned, you knew, you caught the bus. And
it wasn't forced
on
you. I think it's a different story if your agency closes and you're forced to leave at a certain time. I think when you're in the driver's seat and you've made the decision that this is what I want to do, I'm ready to do it, and I'm ready to move on to something new, I think that makes a lot of difference. Because I know in some agencies, especially defense agencies, where bases have closed or they've picked up and moved and employees are facing a decision that they weren't prepared to make, I think it can be a harder adjustment. It takes a little bit more adjusting once you've left.
All righty. We're down to our final minute and a half, I believe. I just got the high sign. Ernie, final comments?
I very much enjoyed my federal career. The FBI is a wonderful place to work, lots of opportunities, and but I look back on it with pride, but I'm also looking at having a nice retirement as well.
So, good, thanks for sharing it, and I just like your upbeat attitude and what you did and how you did it, and should be an incentive for all those listening in the early to mid-career portion of their careers. And Tammy, final comments?
I just think it's a great story, and it's an inspiration, I think, to a lot of people listening. So I appreciate you being here, Ernie.
Thank you, Tammy.
And Ernie, you can't tell, but he smiles well, too. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again next Monday. And I'm going to get shot one of these days because I can never remember who's on next week, but it will be good. Bye-bye.
There are those who dedicate themselves to a sense of honor, to a life of courage, and a commitment to something greater than themselves. They have always defended this nation and each other. They still do. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Connect with Federal News Radio wherever you are. Like us on Facebook to see the hottest news stories on your wall. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio. Download our free iPhone app. Just go to the App Store and search for Federal News Radio. And now, connect to the radio station straight from your cell phone. Just call 712-432-6616. Go to federalnewsradio.com and search for social media for details.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington, the Washington, D.C. home of Navy Athletics.
Are you on Facebook? Do you Twitter? So does Federal News Radio. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FedNewsRadio or join the Federal News Radio Facebook group. For the latest in federal news and government contracting, visit our website, federalnewsradio.com. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.